Welcome, welcome, welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, we kind of teased today's show yesterday during our chat. Because a week ago today, UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson was gunned down in New York City. We talked about it on NPR News. And his alleged killer, 26-year-old Luigi Mangione, was captured Monday in Altoona, Pennsylvania. But what we're talking about is the fact that almost immediately after Thompson, who was a husband and a father of two, was murdered, the public reaction was jaw-dropping and, I dare say, unprecedented. In case you haven't heard some of the comments, I just went to Facebook just to look at a few that I found over the past few days. Here's one comment. It says, he hasn't met his sympathy deductible, no condolence coverage. Another one comment says, he indirectly killed thousands of people by giving a directive to deny claims for life-saving procedures. I don't feel a bit sorry for him. Now, there are other comments, of course, that have condemned that type of reaction. But, you know, it got us to thinking, like, why? Why were so many people actually happy that this man was murdered? And the hashtag Free Luigi was actually trending. And now thousands of dollars have been raised to support a defense of the alleged shooter. So we do what we do here, Avi, at Studio 2. We have a couple of experts. They're going to come on the show, help us talk through this. And our question for you listeners is, what does the killing of the UnitedHealthcare CEO and this online reaction say about the failings of our healthcare system? And what do you make of the jaded, even celebratory reaction online? Does this signal a decline in just our empathy? You can call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. I don't know if you were shocked by any of these comments, how you felt about it. Yeah,
sure. Yeah. I mean, well, the whole thing's unprecedented. I don't want to, you know, talk too much about what I thought about it. I really want to hear from you folks out there. 888-477-9499. Studio2@whyy.org. But first, a trio of local news stories. And let's start with a little sound from Philadelphia City Council this morning. Roll the tape. Build it, build it, build it. It would be the Sixers Arena, a key vote scheduled, and I highlight that word, scheduled for today in Philadelphia City Council that could signal that this arena in the Market East section of the city is going to happen or is going to not happen. This is a city council vote. It's technically a committee vote, but it's a committee of the whole, so it involves everybody in the city council. Nine votes is what you need to either approve it or not approve it. We've talked about this arena ad nauseum. Today could be the day. We thought there was going to be a session this morning at 9 a.m. to vote on a package that would either greenlight or not greenlight the arena. That got delayed to at least 4 o'clock this afternoon. So clearly, parties are talking.
Yeah, a lot of negotiations to be had. And we talked about this on the show before, Avi. The leaders in Chinatown had put up $163 million in demands. Mm-hmm. And they still wouldn't endorse the deal, but they're saying this is the bare minimum we need in order to preserve Chinatown. And so I think a lot of it is about, you know, trying to get more for Chinatown if folks are going to approve this.
The sticking point seems to be the community benefits agreement that the Sixers would offer in exchange for approval. That number for the CBA came in initially around $50 million. It seems like City Council, from what we can tell and what the Inquirer has reported, is pushing for a number significantly higher than that. $100 million, $200 million, $300 million. So the fact that this vote was delayed seems to suggest things are moving, people are talking. But, you know, we don't really have a lot of insight until those council members get in front of a package and say yes or no. And they have not done that yet. So we shall see. It could be today. The Sixers say this has got to happen soon or we will not be able to meet our timeline to open this arena by 2031. That's when their lease expires in their current arena down in South Philadelphia.
And of course, the Chinatown leaders, they're pressing those same city council members to say, hey, what's the rush?
And I will say quickly, the fact that this is the conversation we're having at the 11th hour tells me how much just conversations around arenas being built in cities has changed. Because if you go back 50 years, the conversation was how much should taxpayers
and
pay
this is not a taxpayer issue,
to fund the arena. Mm-hmm. Like taxpayers built Veterans Stadium mm-hmm. with bonds voted on by taxpayers. Go back 25 years ago, the question was, well, we're not going to build the whole arena for you, but how much should we contribute? Because if you look at the current crop of arenas, those were all subsidized. Now, the shoe is kind of on the other foot, and cities have more of an upper hand in these negotiations. And
they can
say,
us?
What are you going to pay us? Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that's an argument that they should approve or not approve. I'm saying it just shows you how much leverage has changed over the years. And I could get into the reasons why, perhaps on another show. But clearly, both parties can see mm-hmm. that the power balance has changed in these negotiations. And today we're seeing it play out right here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing what is going to happen here. Another story, we're going to go over to Jersey. I guess it's all over the region. I don't know if you heard about this, but lawmakers, residents, and investigators, they are concerned yet clueless.
About
numerous recent drone sightings in New Jersey and the greater Philadelphia area. Dozens of large drones have been spotted at night across this area in recent weeks. In New Jersey, the sightings included sensitive areas such as near a military research facility, as well as over one of President-elect Donald Trump's golf courses. And right now, local, state, and federal authorities, including the FBI and DHS, they are investigating, but they have no idea who is behind these drones that are flying out. It's a little freaky.
This story is perfectly calibrated to freak me out.
They're
large
big
objects floating, hovering ominously. 11 sightings in the last month.
Yes, yes.
I'm freaked out, man.
It's very freaky. And the thing is, you hear folks like Governor Phil Murphy, who says, I understand your frustration. He said that they are taking the matter seriously, but at this point, there's no reason to fear for your safety or anything.
I'll try to dial
it back. But then there's also GOP leaders who are saying, look, you know, we need a limited state of emergency to ban all drones until these mysterious sightings are explained. So no one knows, but they're looking into it. And what's interesting is these drones that have been sighted are larger than the ones that people who love to fly drones typically.
These aren't hobbyist drones.
No, these are big. And the size of them is what makes it so unusual and what makes people so concerned.
I'm trying not to. If the governor says I shouldn't be freaking out, I'm going to try not to freak out.
Yeah.
But this does genuinely unnerve me. I don't know. This is something that I can't express why, but it strikes a chord very deep in me. The idea of something in the air mm-hmm. and it's mechanical and it's just sitting there flashing. It's so ominous to me.
But you know what? 21 mayors from New Jersey towns, they wrote to the governor. They want a response. And I should say that drones are legal in New Jersey for recreational and commercial use, but they are subject to local and FAA regulations and flight restrictions. But so far, nothing bad has happened.
I got to cleanse my palate with some chocolate for the third story. Ooh, I got to cleanse my palate.
I love it.
Bloomberg reporting that an iconic Pennsylvania company could be up for sale.
Okay.
Mondelez International, huge food conglomerate, is reportedly putting in a bid for the Hershey Company.
Ooh.
Hershey Company, you know Hershey.
Yes.
Hershey's Kiss.
I've been to Hershey's
Reese's.
Park.
I grew up going to Hershey's Park. Every year we went to Hershey Park. Lovely location. Hershey, like I said, an iconic.
It's a beautiful place. Just the town, like the town.
It is very nice.
Yeah,
it's a weird place too, because they have all this like Gilded Age infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Like one of the nicest theaters I ever went to was in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Oh. And it's because there was just like an uncommonly high number of rich people hanging out in Hershey, right? And probably still is.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, so the Hershey Trust Company holds 80% of the voting power in this situation. It's unclear if they will accept this reported bid. Mondelez, which is sort of part of the Kraft empire, did attempt to buy Hershey back in 2016. Bid was rejected. But if this goes through, it could be that this local company, which is still locally controlled, could finally be bought out by one of the big food companies. So we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, and but Hershey's been dealing with a lot. I was reading up, preparing for this today. I mean, they've had high sugar prices.
High sugar.
High cocoa prices.
I heard cocoa's through the roof.
Through the roof. And people are cutting back on spending. I guess, you know, if you had to cut something from your budget.
Can I throw one more thing in there?
you'd cut the chocolate. I don't know. Yeah.
Also, and I'm not being facetious. I think Ozempic is part of this.
People, oh my goodness.
People are projecting forward how much people will eat, frankly. And if more and more people, we talked about this on a prior show.
You don't
show.
Crave it anymore.
If you don't crave it, like, right. Yeah. It's sort of, the price of these things is somewhat predicated on the overconsumption of them, mm-hmm. right? And so I do think that's something that investors look at.
Yeah, and I got to say, my favorite is the Reese's peanut butter cups. I'm not a big chocolate eater, but I do love peanut butter. Yeah.
You're not a chocolate eater?
No. Sorry. But I love Hershey's, though. Hey.
Whoa, rewind. I didn't know that about
you.
Yeah,
not a big chocolate
person. So you go for the other candies?
I go, but I like peanut butter and peanuts. So, yeah.
Like a payday.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, maybe a Mr. Good Bar. Yeah. I'd eat that.
But then when you go for the fruitier ones.
I like the gummy bears and stuff.
We are yin and yang on that.
I know. You're like, give me the chocolate.
I try to stay away from it these days. So we'll turn now to our main conversation for the rest of the hour. And we're going to start, of course, with the facts. The brazen killing of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson. And then the public reaction to it, Cherry.
Yeah.
Even before the alleged suspect, Luigi Mangione, was apprehended in Altoona, Pennsylvania, lots of folks were celebrating the murder online and praising the killer. Within hours, hats, sweaters, and other merchandise with the words deny, defend, depose were being sold online, a reference to the tactics insurers use to avoid paying claims.
So how do you explain all the vitriol toward health insurance companies? Is it tapping into genuine frustration with a broken healthcare system? Or does this reveal a deeper cultural decline and erosion of empathy? Joining us to talk about this, we have Wendell Potter, a former health insurance executive turned whistleblower. He's the president of the Center for Health and Democracy and writes the newsletter Healthcare Uncovered. Wendell, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you, Cherry. Thank you very much.
We also have Nicholas Florco, a staff writer for The Atlantic. Nick, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And our question for the listeners this hour, I'm not sure they need a prompt because the responses are already flowing in, but we do have one. The question for you is, what does the killing of the United Healthcare CEO and the reaction online say about our healthcare system? And what do you make of the jaded, even celebratory response? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Yeah, we have a couple callers on the line. We're going to bring them in just a moment. But we wanted to start this conversation by just getting your reaction to the reaction that came immediately after Brian Thompson was murdered. Wendell, we'll start with you, then we'll go to Nick. Your immediate thoughts to this reaction, and were you surprised at all? Wendell first.
You know, I was surprised at the murder. I don't know that I can remember the last time a corporate assassination in this country, and this obviously has been high profile for a good reason. But I wasn't, frankly, all that shocked by the response on social media. I was an executive of insurance companies for 20 years, and I know that there has always been this seething outrage among a lot of people toward insurance companies. And in many cases, I think it's just been below the surface. And something like this brought it out in such large numbers. I think that said, I think we probably have seen over the last several years that people are pretty unkind on social media. That's just kind of goes without saying. But I think in this case, it is just pent-up frustration and people just wanting to express their anger at the way our system of health insurance has developed and the challenges that so many of us now are facing to get the care that we need, even though we're paying premiums, more for premiums every single year, and also more out of our own pockets before our coverage kicks in. People are just finding it just outrageous that we're having to pay so much and getting so far less for what we're paying than we used to.
Yeah. And Nick, your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, I was horrified, but I don't know if I was necessarily surprised. Going to your earlier question about whether this says something about our healthcare system or the coarsening of discourse more generally, I think both can be true. We know that people are in this country are really struggling with healthcare costs. A recent poll that I saw said that one in four adults in the past 12 months reported that they or a family member skipped care because of cost. When you have a situation like that, people are going to understandably get angry. But I also think this does show a coarsening discourse overall. I mean, we're seeing multiple metrics of this happening, and we're seeing hate crimes rising. We're seeing gun ownership rising. These sorts of things don't happen unless there is this sort of coarsening of general discourse.
Let me bring in a caller now to keep this conversation going. We've got Katie on the line here from Northwest Philadelphia. Katie, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. So my comment is more so that, of course, the public's response is unsurprising. I think everybody either has personally experienced or knows someone who has experienced denial of care from an insurance company, either as a patient or a provider. So it's very hard for anyone to really have any sympathy for a murder, which it was a murder, but could you not argue that the continuing denial of care and making it hard to get the care you need, couldn't those also be murders?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. That's Katie from Northwest Philadelphia. So summing up how a lot of folks feel.
Yeah.
And let me use that to ask you a question, Wendell Potter, because the insurance company, they're the ones that are in the position of approving or denying the care. So that means they're kind of interfacing with the public in this potentially, very, very, fractious way, right? Are they the ones that are mostly to blame, though, for the increased costs in healthcare? Like, what part of the problem are they versus the drug companies, versus the hospitals? Help us break it down.
I think they deserve a lot of blame, and they certainly deserve much of the blame for our lack of access to the care. And that lack of access is increasing every single year. The insurance industry has two ways of trying to control healthcare costs. One is to try to control or have some bearing on the cost of a stay in the hospital, or a prescription medication, or an MRI, or some other kind of test. That is, in other words, their ability to try to control, if not reduce, the cost of the unit cost of a good of goods and services. The other is to restrict utilization to those goods and services. And that's where they excel and where they focus so much of their time and attention. In fact,
Why is that? Why do they focus on that lever when, like you said, there's sort of two ways to go about this?
there's two reasons. One, they're often quite unsuccessful in negotiating with drug companies and hospitals and even physician practices to bring the cost of care down. And they always anticipate, and I know this from having handled financial communications for Cigna for many years, insurance companies anticipate how much more healthcare is going to cost in the coming year. And that's how they base their premiums. They have a markup based on how much they expect. They're not successful because they're not as good negotiating as the government is in setting prices in the like for the Medicare program. So they're just unable to. But here's the other thing too. They're not all that they don't care all that much because as to be frank, because as hospital prices go up and drug prices go up, these companies are able to ask for and get premium increases every single year. And our employers, most of us who get our coverage privately, get it through an employer, have been going along with this. So they have been, I think, complicit in rising healthcare costs and not holding these companies accountable in that regard. So what they do as an alternative is make it more difficult for us to get the care that in many cases is medically necessary, that our doctors prescribe for us, whether it's a drug or a treatment or a stay in the hospital. And that's where they've been very successful. And that's what Wall Street is watching and rewarding them for. It's called medical cost management or utilization management. And Wall Street, these are publicly traded companies. And it's notable that Brian Thompson was in New York for the company's Investor Day. It's notable that he was there for that because That is the stakeholder that is most important to these companies, they being shareholders, but also Wall Street financial analysts, people that most folks never even heard of or know exist, but they're inordinately influential. And collectively, I've often said that our healthcare system, certainly our health insurance system, is largely controlled by Wall Street and Wall
Wow.
Street's expectations for more and more profits.
Yeah, I want to read this comment. It's an email from Gloria who says these for-profit companies make decisions based on profits, not on health care. They deny many necessary treatments and life-saving care. Their administrative costs are far higher than Medicare. We need Medicare for all. And so, Nick, I want to bring you back in the conversation. And I think Wendell sort of teed this up by talking about UnitedHealthcare specifically. Can you talk about where they sit in this ecosphere of healthcare? Because I've read that they're a pretty large company and touch millions and millions of Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they are, by most measures, the largest health insurer in this country. They are absolutely gigantic. But I think it is important to know that they are not the only ones that are doing these sorts of tactics to deny care to people. Cigna, for example, one of United's biggest competitors, there was some great reporting from ProPublica last year that found that that company had actually set up a system that let doctors deny insurance claims without even opening a patient's file. So, claims are supposed to be adjudicated based on whether they're medically necessary. You obviously can't make that decision when you don't even open a patient's file. United is the largest health insurer, and that's why we often pay the most attention to it. But the tactics that they use by and large are part and parcel to the tactics used by other insurers as well.
Let me bring in another perspective here from Deborah, who says, no doubt health insurers in this country are draconian in many of their decisions, but this murder is absolutely tragic, just like every other murder is tragic. Unfortunately, I believe Trumpism, for lack of a better term, has released a callous insensitivity to such things. Very sad state of affairs. That's according to Deborah. We're coming up on a break. Let me bring in another caller now. This is Jacob from West Philadelphia. Jacob, I think you're going to take us to the break. You're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I just want to say, echo this comment that was just read, that I agree every murder is a tragedy, every death is a tragedy. Human life is valuable. But the true, I guess, villain here is the healthcare company. They have, with, for lack of a better word, they've killed many, many, many more people than were shot in Midtown Manhattan. And it makes sense to me why somebody would get to the point where they would feel that this was necessary.
Wow.
That's Jacob in West Philadelphia. So we're about to go to a break,
Yeah.
but let me ask you real quick, Nick Florco. Do you feel like the insurance companies are the primary drivers of cost in the system? What is their responsibility versus the other players who are also out for profit? If you could try to break it down.
I mean, everyone is to blame for the rising healthcare costs in this country. And I know that's not a very satisfying answer, but the reason why insurance companies have to negotiate or they have to deny access to care is because they're trying to contain the cost of the services that either a hospital or a doctor's office or a drug maker sets. Those folks set these prices. So when somebody goes into the pharmacy and they're told their drug costs $200, the insurers are right that if the drug maker lowered that price, that the price would likely go down for the patient.
Right.
But at the same time, insurers are also at fault because often they will, put up barriers to accessing these drugs. And
Yeah.
so, I mean, it really is, it's everybody. And after the break, I'd love to get into
Yeah.
this talk about shareholders and really who's to blame, because I think if you follow this logic, it gets really messy really quickly on just who is the actual villain here.
All
Yeah,
right. All right.
and we'll definitely talk about who's to blame, accountability, and also could this be a moment where we could get the political will to sort of fix some of these problems? We'll talk about that. Join the conversation. What does the killing of the UnitedHealthcare CEO and the reaction online say about our healthcare system? Join the conversation 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. And we'll be right back with Studio 2 after our break. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We are talking today about public reaction to the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson.
So this hour, we've been asking, what does this hostility and anger toward insurance executives tell us about our healthcare system and about our culture? We have two guests with us. We have Wendell Potter, a former health insurance executive turned whistleblower. He's the president of the Center for Health and Democracy and writes the newsletter Healthcare Uncovered. We also have Nick Florco, a staff writer for The Atlantic. And we want to hear from you. Our question for today is, what does the killing of the UnitedHealthcare CEO and the reaction online say about our healthcare system? And what do you make of the jaded, even celebratory response? We hope you give us a call, 888-477-9499.
Nick Florco, before the break, you were talking about the real villain, like who they are, if we can even single one out. I want you to expand on that point, because this is a large and complicated system that has been put together in layers over many, many years. So break it down for us.
Absolutely. I don't think that you can pinpoint one person as the villain here. And I think it's important that we think about what it would mean to take the logic of this murder to its logical end. So, I mean, there's a lot of people involved both up and down the chain of command at a company like UnitedHealthcare that plays a role in this system. So, as Wendell already mentioned, you know, Brian Thompson and his ilk, they answer to shareholders, they answer to Wall Street analysts. Yes, CEOs do play a role in setting the course for a company, but they also have someone they're trying to answer to. And then also down the chain, I mean, we have plenty of people at these companies who are the ones that actually essentially decide whether a bill gets paid or not. And I think if we accept that the murder of Mr. Thompson is justified, which, to be clear, I don't think that is the case, I think that then leaves open the really dangerous possibility that we would also think that the murder of shareholders, of staffers, of basically anyone involved in the insurance industry would be justified. And I think as a society, we all just We shouldn't go there. We should recognize that we shouldn't go there.
Well, like if I am invested in a mutual fund that happens mm-hmm. to also have some stake in a healthcare company, I guess I would be in some ways complicit. I don't know if I do, but I think that's kind of the point you're making.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, there are plenty of – and there's folks that even have a more direct role in this than just holding a mutual fund that you could argue play a role in harming Americans because of their skimpy insurance. But I just – it's really dangerous to try to signal one person out, especially in a company as large as UnitedHealthcare. I think we should have a debate over whether insurance could be reformed and whether insurers are abusing their power. But I think if we're going to blaming one person and even suggesting that they deserve to be killed, I think that's where it gets really dangerous.
Yeah, I want to bring another caller into the conversation. We have Stephen from Philadelphia on the line. Stephen, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Oh, thank you. It was a comment. I feel that the anger and celebration over this murder reflects, and the widespread nature of it reflects a discontent of people and the feeling of powerlessness. I see it as a failure of democracy. That's something that is so widespread and so intimate has not been addressed with our democracy, with our government. There's no response possible to denial of service with an insurer. Whereas if it's in the VA or in the Medicare system, we have hearings. If a doctor got shot or someone got, there would be hearings. There would be a congressional response over lack of care. As it is now, there is nothing with the medical system. The VA and the Medicare system among the elderly are the most popular medical systems in the nation, and I believe the lowest cost. That's my comment.
Yeah, thank you so much, Stephen from Philadelphia. Wendell, I wanted to bring you into the conversation, and kind of my thought was going down the line of what Stephen is talking about, this feeling that there is this lack of accountability. Is there, I mean, how do you sort of address this? Like there's, you know, Nick, we're all talking about who to blame, and there's so many people to blame. But how do you sort of inject some accountability into this? Because you talked about this building tension with healthcare system and this anger that has been growing for a long time. You know, how do you sort of inject some accountability and try to fix some of these problems? Wendell.
You know, Stephen alluded to something, even mentioned the word that is very important, is democracy. And that word is in the nonprofit I lead, the Center for Health and Democracy. And here's why it's in my nonprofit's name. we have allowed big moneyed interests to really control the levers of government and public policy in this country. When I was at Cigna, and I was there for 15 years, and Nick is exactly right, this outpouring of rage is not just directed toward one company, it's toward the industry, including Cigna, where I used to work, which Nick is right. There were published reports that it has refused to pay for thousands of claims in one fell swoop using artificial intelligence. But these companies also spend a lot of our premium dollars on campaign contributions, on lobbying. And my team and I used to dole out campaign contributions. We would write talking points for our lobbyists. They spend enormous amounts of money on what I refer to as propaganda. In fact, if it's more truthful, my title would have been Vice President of Propaganda rather than Corporate Communications. They even spend money through charitable donations to buy goodwill. I know that because I headed the foundation for one of these companies for quite a while. So they've been able to spend all of this money to, and I call it protection money, to enable them to grow to this massive size. United, as Nick alluded to, is massive. It's the fourth largest company in the country in terms of revenue. The only companies that are bigger in this country are Walmart, Amazon, and Apple. Cigna's not too far down the list. They've become massive. They're not just health insurers either. They've gotten increasingly into healthcare delivery. It's called vertical integration. When I was in the industry, it was largely they got bigger by buying smaller competitors. That's how they got to be big in the first place. But increasingly in recent years, they've been buying up physician practices and clinics. And they operate these enormous entities called pharmacy benefit managers or PBMs, which are also middlemen that extract huge sums of money out of the pharmacy supply chain. It's one reason why we have to pay so much for our drugs at the pharmacy counter, even with health insurance. It has become a huge cash cow.
And my quick follow-up is a way to sort of, and I wanted to read this factoid. United Healthcare has the highest claim denial rate of any private health insurance company at 32%. It's doubled the industry average. That's according to some information I saw in reporting. And is a way to sort of, Wendell, as a follow-up, is a way to inject accountability, is it to break up the largeness of some of these companies, make them smaller or not for profit, to break it down so you can have accountability?
You know, believe it or not, there is bipartisan interest and support for exactly that. There's one Republican member of Congress who's a pharmacist. His name is Buddy Carter, a Republican from Savannah, who has called for the breakup of United in particular. United being one of the companies that has a big PBM. Cigna is another one. And CVS, which also owns Aetna, has a PBM also. Collectively, those three companies control 80% of the pharmacy benefit management market. So, yes, I think that's a possibility. And regulators, too. In the Biden administration, the Department of Justice, the FTC have been investigating these companies, United again in particular. And there are a lot of conservatives who've been supportive of the effort to look at breaking these companies up. Like, you know, at the last Gilded Age, when
the
Standard
trust
Oil.
Busting. Yeah.
Yes. We could be seeing the same kind of thing.
Let me read this email from Walter, who says the only surprising thing is that NPR and MSNBC have not covered the dysfunctional healthcare system on a daily basis. I would dispute that, but it took the killing of a healthcare exec to put it on the front page. I would agree with that. Why we tolerate a market-based healthcare system is the tragedy of our country. It's bankrupting patients and ballooning our federal deficit. That's Walter's perspective. And I think that's the elephant in the room, right, Nick? Like, should we go to single payer healthcare coverage in this company? Now, I would imagine, even in a single payer system, some care has to be denied. If we're all, you know, if we're sharing the cost together, we can't green light every single procedure and every, you know, single medicine. So, in a single payer system, how does coverage and denial of coverage work?
Well, I think you're right, first of all, that even in a system like that, some care does get denied. I mean, I think about Medicare, for example. Medicare is probably our most popular public insurance system. Claims get denied in Medicare as well. Now, reports suggest that they get denied at a lower rate than a company like United. So that is something to keep in mind. But that still does happen. And I know Wendell has looked a lot into sort of the systems in other countries and whether, they provide more benefit than ours. But I think the important thing that I would emphasize is that we are pretty much the only country in the industrialized world who doesn't have some sort of single payer system. So we are the outliers here, and I think we can and should have a debate on whether that is a good thing or not.
Yeah, I want to bring in another caller. We have Steve from Philadelphia who wants to weigh in. Steve, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. My comments are about the reactions. I don't find it outrageous that people are being gleeful. I don't agree with it, but it to me, it reminds me of the French Revolution when the peasants cheered when the aristocracy had their heads cut off. They had been abused by the aristocracy. They were gleeful when they were eliminated, a harsh thing, but it's a natural reaction, I think. Also, the thing about I believe that there is an inherent conflict of interest when you have a for-profit medical or healthcare model. If someone if a CEO has to make a profit, they're going to make decisions ultimately and to some degree that are not purely about healthcare. So I think that the model is built on what I believe is a conflict of interest.
Yeah, thank you. That's Steve from Philadelphia. By the way, you can join this conversation. What do you make of the jaded, even celebratory response to the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO and also the reaction online? Please give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. Wendell, this goes to a question that I kind of teased before the break. Does this reaction, does the killing of Brian Thompson sort of tee us up for major debate and maybe even the political will to make change to what many people are saying and what we hear from our callers and all our commenters to a broken system?
I think it does. I spend a lot of time talking to advocates, to other advocates. This is presenting a new opportunity for a discussion about how our healthcare system is organized, and even whether we should call it a system. It is more, I've heard many people call it just a something other than that, just a disease business, if you will. But we are an outlier. We are the only country on the planet that essentially allows Wall Street, or at least for-profit entities, to control so much a part of our healthcare system, and we're seeing the consequences of that. We've allowed this model to try to work for decades, and we're seeing every year the empirical evidence that it just simply doesn't. The interests of patients are absolutely at odds with the interest of shareholders when you're talking about health insurance companies. I saw that up close and personal when I was handling financial communications for Cigna. These shareholders want these companies to spend less and less of premium dollars every year, actually every quarter, on healthcare than they did the quarter before or the year before. It's something called a medical loss ratio. Insurance companies consider it a loss every time they pay a claim or pay for someone's healthcare. So it is a system that absolutely, I don't think will ever work because of the divergence of interest between those who own these companies, which are shareholders and want to have an increasingly attractive shareholder return, and people who just want to get the care that they need paid for. And that's the inherent problem here.
Stephanie says, "I think the lack of empathy in people's reactions is a trickle-down result of the lack of empathy in corporate America for everyday citizens. Healthcare hits citizens where they live." And if indeed this becomes a catalyst for change, Nick Florco, I got to imagine it's an incentive for the next person who has a problem with another institution in American life. Because if you kill someone and then that causes people to react to change the system that you're raging against, that does seem like on some level an incentive for the next person to do a similar thing. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest, my biggest worries coming out of this situation. And I should say, I am less bullish on the thought that this will lead to some significant change. I mean, we really still don't know a lot about Mr. Mangione's motives here. We don't know what he will end up being, how much of a quality messenger he will end up being for this cause. I think there's very much a situation that could happen where, we find out that you know, Mr. Mangione did not have as well thought out views on healthcare as folks might like. And then we end up having a situation where the movement to actually reform healthcare is hurt by this.
Right.
You know, there's really a situation where, you know, this all backfires. I don't necessarily think a man being killed in the street will lead Congress to, you know, redo our entire healthcare system. That just seems...
Let me ask another question then, Nick, because I think there is this split in American life right now, and it's not so much left and right. It's between people who want to reform our big systems, be they financial or political, and people who want to tear them down. When it comes to healthcare, what is the right approach? Is it a reform approach? Is it an incremental approach? Or should the solution be tear it down to the studs and rebuild it?
The million-dollar question, I don't know if I'm going to be able to give you a satisfactory answer on where I stand. But
it's a big question, heard, I admit. Yeah, I admit.
We've heard the case for tearing it down from Wendell, so let me at least give some sense of what could happen in a reform situation and what has happened, because I do think there's been some positives. So, for example, Congress recently passed a law that requires that seniors do not pay more than a certain amount of money out of pocket each year for prescription drugs. We also saw Congress step in to end this system of what are called surprise medical bills, where people, you know, end up going to the hospital and they end up seeing a doctor that unbeknownst to them was outside of their insurance network and they receive a bill. Those are the sorts of things that Congress has stepped in to fix. And they are pitching other solutions. So, I mean, Joe Biden, for example, had called for that cap on out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs to be expanded to everyone in private insurance. That obviously would make a huge difference. We also have groups like the American Medical Association that are calling for reforms to a lot of the tactics insurers use, like this one called prior authorization, where insurers can essentially second guess the prescription that a doctor writes. You can make an argument that those sorts of problems can be fixed while keeping our larger system. The argument around the larger system is essentially, I mean, it's essentially the logic of capitalism, right? It's that these companies that have a financial incentive to make money will also serve the financial incentive of keeping healthcare costs down through that. And you can have an argument about whether that works or whether that doesn't, but I don't think that that argument has been really discussed today. So I just want to bring it up.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. I want to read a couple comments. Jeff says, there are several industries where an event like this would be celebrated. I think it says a lot about business versus consumers. That's from Jeff. Sarah writes, maybe Wall Street should not be involved in healthcare. I wonder whether we could set up insurance companies that would operate as cooperatives owned by their subscribers. Hmm. So I always like when we have big problems like this, I like to ask the question, if you were in charge, like if there was like, if you were given the magic wand, Wendell, Nick, if you were given that and said there's one thing you could do, you could waive this, what do you think would be the one thing you would focus on to sort of alleviate some of this frustration that millions and millions of people are feeling every day? Wendell, we'll start with you. Yeah.
Okay. At some point, we may need to tear it down to the studs. But as Nick pointed out, that is a very big undertaking. I advocate for incremental reforms through my nonprofit. I also lead an organization called Lower Out of Pockets Now, which is focused on trying to do exactly what President Biden has proposed, to extend that cap on out of pockets for prescription drugs to everybody. We proposed that before the president did, and we're pleased to see that that was enacted for Medicare beneficiaries. We also support changes in prior authorization and also reforming these pharmacy benefit managers. There's bipartisan support for that. So you need, I think, for us who are advocates to stay engaged in the fight on an incremental basis. But I think, as we were saying before, our system is fundamentally different from any other system in the world. And I think that we are going to be seeing that employers will ultimately start stepping up and talking about reforms beyond what we've seen so far. That said, it's extraordinarily difficult for reform to happen in Washington or the state capitals. The Affordable Care Act passed by just one vote in 2010 when Democrats had 60 votes they could count on in the Senate. So having a time when you have that many lawmakers supportive of any kind of reform, that's extraordinarily difficult and hard to hard for the stars to align for something that like that.
I guess real quick though, Wendell, is there a scenario that's somewhere between tear it down to the studs and incremental change? Like if you could lay out that scenario in maybe 30 seconds, is there a midpoint between those two things?
I think there could be. It'll be interesting to see if there really is an effort to break some of these companies up. We'll be doing a project to show just how big United is. They will resist that. They will spend so much money to try to resist any kind of reform imposed on them. But that may be something that you'll see more of. And I think that if we could go back to the days, it hasn't been all that many years since we had health insurance provided by nonprofits.
Yeah, one of our listeners brought that up. Don Skelly said, you know, Blue Cross Blue Shield used to be a nonprofit. That's a big provider here. So we have to end it there. But let me thank Wendell Potter, former health insurance executive turned whistleblower, president of the Center for Health and Democracy, who writes the newsletter Healthcare Uncovered. Thanks for the time, Wendell. And Nick Florco, staff writer at The Atlantic. Also, thank you to you.
Yes, and thank you to all of our callers and emailers today. And
lots
thank you to our producers. Yes, Debbie Bilder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. We had
Al Banks
and Tina Calique engineering today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.